Hi everyone, you're listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we believe in a world in which Singaporeans are proud of our rich and diverse food culture and play an active role in keeping our food heritage alive. I'm your host, Pamelia Chia, and today I'm joined by Christy Chua and Tan Naik, who is the founder and editorial director, as well as editor-in-chief of The Slow Press. The Slow Press is an independent food magazine fixated on the rich stories behind what we eat, and through long-form journalism, design, illustration, photography, and videography, the magazine seeks to bring Singapore's vibrant food heritage to the foreground in an introspective yet quirky and fun way. In this conversation, they share about their thoughts on producing a print magazine in an increasingly digitalized world, as well as how we can potentially get young Singaporeans interested in heritage food.
So I was flipping through your magazine and also checking out some of your online editions, right? And I realized that a lot of the stories revolve around local food or heritage food. So what was that process of deciding on the theme for your magazine like? Was it a very intentional process of curating the stories?
Yeah, I think it's a very intentional process. But also, I think there are a few things, because food magazines are something that's quite common, actually, you know, in terms of like the media landscape, not just in Singapore, right? Like from the US, from like these countries with a big media presence, there are a lot of food magazines. So if you wanted to do a food magazine, it has to be something that is different, right? And obviously, we're in Singapore. So Singaporean food, what's happening in Singapore, local food, you know, what we term as heritage food, that's something that is right here. And of course, we want to write about that rather than try to write about something that honestly, we don't know much about. And there's, like, for example, there's only so much you can write, you can say about a culture and food that is not where you are, right? And if you have no experience with that. So, of course, naturally, we will gravitate towards food that's right here in Singapore. And I feel like even in like a country like Singapore, you know, it's quite small, whatever. I think there's more than enough to, you can write endlessly about it. You know, it's not like something where, oh, you know, we're a small place, there's not much to write about. I feel like it's really an inexhaustible topic, you know, food and culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's why we wanted to do that.
Yeah. And what is the niche that the Slow Press is trying to fill? I mean, you talked about different food magazines, right? And I mean, locally, even in Singapore, we have quite a few local food magazines. So what is the Slow Press doing that these maybe bigger magazine companies don't do?
I think it's a good thing that we are young people and we are not like directly involved in like the culinary scene. What I have observed before the Slow Press started is that most of the content is written by like people who have like food critic or food writing experience, or they have worked as a chef. That's why they can launch their own like cookbooks. And you yourself also, like Wet Market the Table was one of the reasons why we started the Slow Press, because we were like super inspired by whatever you were doing. And I think because if you are in the scene, then you will have that kind of perspective. But we are kind of from a media background, so we only have the media perspective, but we like food. So I think we want to be the middle ground between like what somebody of like higher authority is trying to like achieve. So we interview them or like we talk to them and summarize their thoughts. So that translates into something that maybe the general audience or younger audience can understand better. And I guess what we want to deliver is like good content in a fun and refreshing way. So that's also through like events and directly contacting some of our readers. Like we wanted to build like quite a strong community that can support us, and we will support them as well in terms of like exchanging food knowledge. Sometimes we have people coming to our events and they bring along their own stash of food magazines collected from over the years, or like, and they share with us and they're like, you don't have to return it to us. Like you can keep it for real. Then we are like so shocked by like how generous these people are. And I think we managed to reach out to quite a large age group. So some of the people who come are really like married, and like some of the people who come are our friends. And we are genuinely quite like amazed by the people who turn up for our events or like engage with us, because we learn so much from them and they are also as eager about food.
So putting my two cents. I also feel like for the Slow Press, we have a larger focus on long-form food writing. So it's like more cultural food, something that's that dives a little bit deeper. And of course, there are like these kinds of features in like current food, like bigger food magazines. But I think the distinguishing the point is that for us, is we try to present a less value-based proposition when it comes to talking about food, right? Because when we started out, at least I felt personally that a lot of the food writing, especially like the more commercial kinds, right? There's a huge focus on value, you know, like is this food worth it at X amount of dollars? You know, where can you like buy this food? But of course, we want to, like, for the slow press, we want to go a little bit beyond that. That's not really what we are looking to do. Yeah, it's more about like the food, the history of the food, rather than how cheap it is, or like how much value for money it is, or is this like 5 stars, 4 stars?
And I think a lot of the stories revolve around home cooking, right? Rather than restaurant-y kind of food. And I was very intrigued by that because I always feel that for young Singaporeans, home cooking is so redundant almost. A lot of the younger people that I know, they don't cook because you live with your parents until you get married, and that's when you move out, right? And then you start embarking on your own personal journey of learning how to cook. So how did you make this topic accessible and interesting to young people?
I think personally, I feel the older I go, I want to keep my mom's recipes with me. Like, I actually fear that one day I move out, I can't eat this as often anymore, and how am I going to recreate it? So I have been feeling that I should ask her more about food and tell her, like, oh, what do you add into this dish? Like, is it soy sauce, fish sauce? Yeah, how do you like cook this kind of vegetables? I'll ask her these kind of questions, I think, like in recent years, especially. Then I feel like home cooking is actually what the young people have been exposed to if they stay at home and eat, right? So even if they don't cook it, they have developed like a liking, and their flavor profiles have been like developed from what they eat at home. And even if they are not like interested in cooking it, I think it still means a lot to them. That's why a lot of our writers and myself can write about like all these things that we grew up eating. And it might be very, very different from what the older generation has eaten, of course, because like times have changed. People don't eat like kampongs or like super huge families anymore. And people don't like go to their neighbors and borrow ingredients or maybe like share a meal at all, maybe today. So even if times have changed, like, family cooking still remains, like, thankfully for my generation, it still remains something that we can look forward to at home. And we just want to continue preserving that. Hopefully the next generation can continue to eat food that their parents cook at home as well.
And yeah, for home cooking is definitely a huge portion of what we do. Because, yeah, the food at home, I think it really touches something in you. And I feel like for a lot of our younger readers, right, even if, yeah, like Chrissy said, even if they don't cook, of course they eat like home-cooked food and they're familiar with that. So when we present stories like this in our magazine, right, someone who's curious about it and, you know, really likes the food might think, oh, like, there's so much here that I see in myself, in my own situation, you know, maybe I should also start, you know, like Chrissy said, right, learning to cook the stuff that I ate growing up, if I want to keep eating it. And then, of course, like, even like in this home cooked food, there's so much like food, culture, history, even your own personal family history is like, I think it's very valuable, right? And I hope that if someone reads our stories like this, they will see that they're in a similar situation, and then maybe that will ignite their interest in actually making the food.
Yeah. It's very interesting to hear your perspective because, I think on my second episode of this podcast, I was interviewing another young person and her name is Shiny Pua. I think you guys featured her on the Slow Press as well. And something that she said was very amusing to me. So she said that to her generation, they would consider something like Soon Kueh boomer food. So do you think that this is true from your perspective as another young person, that your generation actually has these labels attached to traditional food?
Yeah, honestly, I think... Obviously, not everybody's the same, but there is definitely this thing where you look at older food and you're like, oh, you know, I've never tried it. It's, you know, some people have never tried it. Like, even Ang Ku Kueh, right? It's like boomer food, something that my parents ate. It's uncool, you know. Yeah, so I feel like part of it is trying to reframe that, you know, where it's like, yeah, it assists history. It's like, I'm not saying it's cool, you know, I'm not trying to make it like cool or whatever, but it's more about showcasing that, and then hopefully you will have interest in it. But yeah, definitely there have been some things that are labeled Puma food. And I do know people that are only interested in things that are, you know, shiny and new, like, oh, it's like pasta. Yeah, not really much interest in traditional food, so to speak. Definitely, you can see that.
I think it's also about how the media and whatever we watch online kind of shapes what we want to eat. Like, especially with like YouTube channels on like how to cook like tasty or like BuzzFeed videos, right? Then people will be like, oh, maybe this weekend I want to go eat burgers. I want to eat like handmade pasta, you know, that's like the hip thing now. And then like young people, they tend to like get their friends to do the same thing as them. So I guess that kind of like interest in like more Western based food or like pastries comes from what we consume online as well. And then like whatever we eat outside of that kind of like gets left behind. Like you won't like go with your friends to the hawker center as much as you go with them to like shopping malls. Yeah, I feel like maybe people don't like specifically go and be like, I want to eat bao for brunch on a Sunday. Let's go eat like char kway teow. Like people are like, oh, let's go eat like brunch, scrambled eggs, avocado toast. Like that's a very easy thing for people to say, but I think people don't really think about like, oh, maybe let's get bak chor mee for Sunday brunch. Yeah.
So along that same vein, what do you think is the overarching mission of the Slow Press?
I think we want to do things about food in terms of journalism, design, illustration, and photography. And it's always about bringing out the fun and without forgetting the amount of death and the whole understanding that can go behind food. And it's not about like what the food is, how much value it is, like how much you rate it against 5, or like whether this is a must try food, but it's more of like, this thing exists in Singapore. I want to talk to you about it. Maybe you like it. Maybe you don't even bother finding out more about it, but at least I tried to do it. So we just want to be the people who start an active conversation about food, and we want to keep it going as long as we can.
So, you know, I'm assuming both of you studied communication, new communication, or is it called communication studies?
Communication studies, yeah.
Okay, communication studies. So how do you think that discipline really helps you in achieving your mission?
I'm the only one from my team who comes from more of a journalism background. And then we had like this school alumni magazine thing. So when I first started Slow Press, I kind of ran it based on my experience on like how the editorial and the creative team works over there. And I think like along the way, Melody, Ike, Lauren, and some others, they also have like some professional experience in internships when they were like in agencies, and the way like people work, I guess workflow wise, we kind of draw from our media backgrounds in like public relations or like advertising as well. But editorial wise, mostly I was the one who like set the timelines because we need to like plan for like pictures to be in, then we need to send out like calls for contributors and stuff. I'm sure you're familiar. And then there's always like this period in between where like people need to go and contact the newsmakers, and some stories work, some stories don't work. And after that, we regroup and we see like, okay, this is the lineup for next volume. We don't really have a theme for the past 4 volumes, so we leave it up to the writers to like decide. And then after that, we go through the whole writing and interviewing process individually. And then like there's the submission of drafts and the editing timeline, which is kind of similar to how any newsroom would work, but on a much longer and slower scale because we are the Slow Press and we take things easy. So
I don't know about taking things easy, man. It's like 4 volumes in 8 months, 9 months, lah. It's very fast paced. We have a lot of contributors that obviously come from a journalism background. You know, they have all these like skills and discipline or whatever. But for me personally, I have to say that I didn't learn anything about journalism because I didn't take any of the modules while I was doing communications. So everything I learned, right, I learned from Christy. I'm like everything I know about like what I like about stories, like I would say actually almost self-taught, like reading a lot of like, you know, long form food content or like just like long form content in general. And that's my personal interest, you know. So that's where my interest and knowledge of what I think is a good story comes from, actually. Yeah.
You know, a lot of people say that print is dead. And especially for younger people, right? Everything is digital right now. So why decide to print your magazine? I know that you guys have a digital version on your website and you also do print. So why do print?
Right. We wanted to do both because we wanted everyone to be able to read it. Some people aren't compelled to like pay like maybe $15 to $20 just to own a copy because they're not quite sure if it's their thing. So digital was a way for us to reach out to people who are still quite uncertain to like, should I like patronize this magazine? Maybe I can take a look. And maybe they stay for like 2 pages or 5 pages, but at least they get to look at what's inside, and we appreciate that quite a bit. So we wanted to do print because we wanted to retain an audience which was really interested in our stories. I think for long form, print really makes a difference. Because imagine you're scrolling through like 3,000 words on your phone, you'll really get bored halfway or like distracted by your notifications, right? Long form is quite hard to read on the phone. Even for like other media sites, I'm sure like they probably suffer from the same issues. And because for print, design is quite different as well. If you're posting it on a website, you probably just need to like include some photos in between, cover image. You can't really design the spread to make it look like, oh, this is a magazine, this is 2 pieces of A4 paper, and I want this at this corner, this over here, and everything makes sense differently when it's put on paper. It's something that we have been struggling, trying to adapt to when we first started, because we didn't know things would turn out so differently when they're printed. Like, we need to take note of like the center puffing and like making sure the words don't like cut into the images and stuff like that. It's very technical things that we learn along the way because we're also not from like publishing background. So that really was quite challenging for us. But I think like print culture wise, the indie print culture is still thriving in terms of like maybe magazines that publish like once a year, your Mean Time Zine, Minor, and like other Singapore magazines, right? There's this small little circle of them who still go for like art.
You mean like there. Even like Seasonings also, right? Shout out Seasonings.
Yeah, so you guys are in the print zone as well. And I think we just do it because we want people to have something to keep, something to touch, and something to hold on to. So next time when like if like everything gets lost and the internet breaks down, like we still have the press at home to read.
The answer is that print is dying. But I mean, it's dying in the same way that like radio died, right? I feel, because it's like print is no longer the mass communication medium of the day, right? Obviously, you have like so many different things. You have like TV, the internet, whatever. But there's definitely still artistic potential in the magazine as a medium, or like the print like book as like a object, right? So I feel like that's a lot of what we like, and that's why we decided to do print, because we still want to have that, keep that spirit alive. And yeah, there's like this like DIY zine culture that we take a lot of inspiration from. Yeah, and definitely having it in print, you know, having object, like Christy said, all these like specifications about how you can put a magazine onto paper, that's a lot of what we are trying to do as well.
Fantastic. One of the stories that I was very pleasantly surprised by is the one which features the Filipino community and their cuisine. Why did you feel like it was important to highlight this community and their food? You know, I mean, the Filipinos, even though they've been working and living in Singapore for so long, I feel that their food or their stories have not really made it into mainstream Singaporean food media. Yes. So why that decision?
Well, I think that it's a shame that they have not so-called made it into mainstream food media. I mean, just like on a personal level, I feel like Filipino food is very delicious. And of course, like the Philippines is a huge place, right? So all these places where you talk about like regional cuisine or whatever applies to the Philippines as well. It's like a huge place. You only get like a sliver of it. So that's like the food part, right? And the culture or like the story, or like the story that I covered, because yeah, I did that piece. I feel like it's really important. Like, back, I mean, this issue of you know, domestic, like foreign domestic workers, all these like issues with overworking or like food deprivation, like slightly touched on in this piece. These things have been going on for a long time. They've seen some, I would say not spotlight, like they've been covered. These issues have been covered in the media fairly recently because of the good work of organizations like, you know, HOME and things like that. And this was just like my little way of me showing that story, you know, through a food lens, because I feel like that's like a very joyful approach to food that I've seen personally, right? And I wanted to like showcase that and also, yeah, lightly touch on some of the issues that they face. Yeah, you know, it's, so that I felt that was important. And of course, when you're talking about Singaporean food, I feel like it's an inclusive term, right? It's food that is in Singapore. So it doesn't have to be like, oh, you know, bak chor mee, char kway teow or whatever. If they are living here and they're working here and they're eating here, right, then I feel that's also a Singaporean story. But very unfortunately, part of the Singaporean story of like Filipino food is that, you know, foreign domestic workers are often not given access to food. So that was like part of why I wanted to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think whatever I said about like people living in Singapore should be considered as a Singaporean story to tell, I think it's very important, because I think a lot of us grew up in a household with a domestic helper, whether it's from like Philippines or like Indonesia. I personally did not. So when I went over to Ike's house to like try the sisig for my first time, it was quite cool because like I've never eaten like pig ears before. And I was like, wow, this texture is very interesting. And I got to see like how his domestic helper was like, and him were like working hand in hand to prepare the dish, and like the camaraderie between each other, it's really very heartwarming and sweet. We have been going back to Ike's house for a few times after that, and to see them like interact and like have fun about like cooking and like eating together, I think it's very precious. And for a lot of households, there's always like this hierarchy between like the Filipino helpers and the employers, right? Like some of them don't really treat them very well, and maybe they tell like the children to like not be so close to them, like don't learn from them. I don't know, that's what I heard growing up from like my relatives and stuff. Like the older generation can still be quite racist when it comes to like interacting with other communities in their household.
I had to beg Christy to try the sisig. I was like, it's like pig ear in the face. Also, and she was like,
but actually it's very Singaporean, like you have things like kway chap, right, which is like,
yeah, exactly.
But actually I feel that a lot of the stalls nowadays, they don't have those things, like they just do the pork belly, tau kwa and the egg, so maybe, you know, that's why Gen Z's are less exposed to it. But speaking from your own experience, like what has gotten you into heritage food and you know, understanding the value of unearthing all these stories and understanding the cultural context?
So in volume 2, I tried something new for the first time, and that was like making ngoh hiang with my family. And I know my grandmother has been making it like almost her whole life, because I have been eating it, but not exactly like interacting and like doing a hands-on activity of like making it with my aunts, right? So I've always eaten it, and every Chinese New Year or any family gathering, it's always like on the table. And then the other stuff on the table are quite foreign to me. Like we have pig intestine soup, and we have like different roast meat and fried noodles and some fried tau kwa and century egg and random stir-fried dishes every time. But I think as a child, like I was very picky. So I would just go for like the fried noodles and like nuggets and fish cake that they were specifically fried for like the children, like me and my cousins, right? So I would like avoid everything else on the table. And then one day, I don't know why, maybe I just like felt a bit curious, then I asked my mother, like, or maybe I just got bored of like eating the same fried noodles every time. I asked my mom, like, can I have a bit of the chicken? And she like got shocked. She's like, you eat chicken? And I think it started from there. I really wanted to know like the hard work that goes into all these dishes. So ngoh hiang is something very central to my family, and it became one of like my favorite stories to write, like from one of your questions, because I went into the whole process and then I saw that like, oh, actually there's like six people making ngoh hiang at once, And then there's so many small details like peeling the water chestnuts and like making sure the onions and like the chives were like just the correct dimensions. Like it has to be like small, and like if not, you will taste it and it'll be a big chunk when it comes out fried, right? And how you roll it. If you don't roll it tight enough, then it will fall out when it's frying, and how long you fry it for, right? Because yeah, you don't want it to burn the hot oil and everything. And I think it's like so labor intensive, like so many other heritage dishes. And it's not something that you can actually like do like when you're working. Like it's not a fast lunch that you can conjure up for yourself. So I like how intentional this whole process is, bringing people together, and it's usually like family members, and it's dedicated the entire weekend to it because you still need to go to the market in the morning and buy the pork belly. And then, yeah, they said like, the market uncle only recognizes my grandma, so she has to go and buy it and like haggle for his prices. So like, even she's like almost like 85 or something now, but she's still the one that's going down to the market like in her neighborhood to get it for the entire family. And she makes up to like 300 rolls pre-COVID because she would visit a lot more of her friends and her cousins and give to like the entire family. Yeah. So I think that got me into more of heritage cooking and also reading up about some of the foods that are local to Singapore. Yeah, I started off from Singapore noodles, actually being exposed to the range of ingredients and all the recipes on your website. Yeah, because it's very accessible, you know, like for a young person, we really don't know where to start. And if we look into like all those family cookbooks from like 1990s, like I'm sure every family has like those boomer cookbooks, you know. But there's not much like content and stories in those cookbooks. It's more of like, okay, today I want to cook fish head curry, so I will go to that specific book, get the recipe, cook it, and everyone's happy. Like, but no one actually thought about like, so where did fish head curry come from? Is it a Singaporean dish, or like how did people enjoy it in the past? And because of that curiosity, I think that's why we wanted to cover a bit more of it in the school press.
Well, my interest in heritage food is because it's delicious. You know what I'm saying? No, it's like delicious. Really, like as you get older, you venture out of your comfort zone. You start being a fried chicken nugget girl, right? And then you start like trying everything, and then you're like, oh, this is actually really really good. Something that my parents eat that I don't eat. It's like, oh wow, it's actually very delicious. And from there, at least for me, you want to find out more about it. You want to find out, all these like different stories about the food. Yeah, and it's like so interesting and so fascinating to look into. So I guess that's where my curiosity developed, right? And then it just like took off from there.
Do you feel like both of you are belonging to the minority Gen Zs that are out there in Singapore?
Yeah, maybe, honestly. Yes.
Because I have this brother who is 9 years younger than I am. Right. So he's probably around your age. And I have like really young cousins as well. And I think one of the reasons why I wrote Wet Market to Table the way I did, or positioned Singapore noodles in the way that I did, was because I realized how little they actually knew about heritage food and perhaps how uninterested they are. I feel that young people have always been said to be like very trans-led, you know, grew up on McDonald's, you know, very little anchoring to their own heritage. And so I really felt the need on my part to make it hip and trendy and accessible, whether it is through the use of technology or through the use of art when I collaborate with people to create products. So for you guys, what are some of these things that you pay special attention to? I mean, previously you talked about creating a sense of community, which I'm sure is a very big thing for Gen Zs, right? But what are some other things that you guys focus on?
I mean, for sure, the design, right? The magazine looks beautiful. Shout out Melody, who's our head designer. And
yeah, Melody, our head designer, makes our branding really like dandy.
I mean, that's the first thing, like it has to pop, right? So people want to read it. And then you have to like lure them in with the pictures.
I think for like our language and tone of voice, and on social media, when we post stories, we try to be like the face of the store press. So we like talking about what we eat as the team and like what we have been cooking at home. And then sometimes we get a lot of DMs saying like, wow, my grandmother would flip if she saw how you make like the spring onion pancake. Like, why are you making it this way? It's like in a casual manner. They're not like trying to say like, why are you cooking like this? Like, this is wrong. But it's more of like bantering with us. Like, why do you choose to cook this? It's not even like a Singaporean food. I don't know. Sometimes like we make like tacos for fun and stuff like that. And like, I guess that starts the conversation, even if it's not like entirely pleasant sometimes, right? But we wanted to bring out like the most organic side of us. Like, we are also learning together with you. And because we don't come from like an expert standpoint, like that stress is like completely eliminated. So when we try to do stuff, we want to do stuff that we enjoy and that you enjoy as well. Like, we haven't really went to the wet market as a team. We only went like once with like Tahira from Spicy Kitchen, right? And that was super eye-opening for us. It was my first time at Geylang Serai Market, and I saw her put like all the vegetables in like a big basket, and the guy only charged us like $1.50 and gave us so much like free curry leaves and like free calamansi and stuff like that. And we were just mind blown by like the fast pace of life in the market, you know, like us just like standing behind like taking the Instagram stories, and then she's really like done paying the guy, and like, yeah. So I think it's a lot of like sharing our experiences, because all these small things amuse us so much. I think like maybe it's because I haven't really been exposed to so much of like heritage food or like Singaporean cooking until I started the Stove Press, but I guess a little bit more experience with that. Like, he uses a pesto and mortar at home and like makes up of
us. Please stop doing this. It's not that special. It's just a pesto and mortar.
You know, but
and we also broke one on our Instagram story, because it's the kind they use for grinding, right? And then we tried to like make pesto with it, and then we broke it. Oh god. Yeah la. No la. I think when people, it's like when you watch other young people cook, right? It's like less intimidating also. And we're also learning, like what Christy
said. Which I love what you guys are saying, because I feel that whether you're a young person or older person like me, right? Like, that fear is always there because you're putting your work out there. And I think I mentioned this in my interview with you guys for the Slow Press, right? Where, you know, through this journey of running Singapore Noodles, there have been people who are like, oh, why do you do this? Why do you do that? And I feel that it, like, this gatekeeping is really creating a lot of fear in younger Singaporeans to even want to try, you know what I mean? It's like if they were actually to put something out there and people were to criticize it, then, you know, how would they find any impetus or motivation or even desire or courage to step forward and say, okay, this is my humble attempt at making this dish. You guys are writing a lot about heritage food. I mean, have you guys ever felt or experienced that kind of fear before putting out a recipe or putting out content? Because, I mean, you guys talked about how you are not in the F&B space, right? So you guys are kind of like observers or the middlemen. So in that sense, without that sense of authority, how do you find the confidence and the courage to put forward such stories?
I definitely hear what you're saying. And there's always definitely a fear, right? It's like, oh shit, am I getting it right? Am I showing the whole picture? So for me, at least personally, I feel what's important is to, first of all, center the voices of people that know the stuff. You know what I mean? Rather than trying to like talk over them, they are the story. You know what I mean? So I try to like let them speak for themselves, and then of course like do your due diligence. You know, talk to people, do your own research, and so that you don't come off like just trying to like get everything from this person. So that's like my approach to it in terms of what I do to try and mitigate that fear of like getting it wrong. Yeah.
I think it's always about like not looking at a community or a certain food as something that is like novel or unique to that culture, because you might come across as like, oh, why didn't you research this before? Like, people will be quite turned off if like you go for an interview or you go to somebody's house and watch them cook, but then you don't even know what like the primary like, fundamentals to like what is a rempa or like what kind of chilies are used in this kind of cuisine. Like, if you go in knowing nothing, like the people will confirm judge you, and like they will just feel very distasteful, like, oh, why don't you respect my culture, right? Like, you shouldn't see another person's, like, you shouldn't want to cover something because it's like
trendy
or like
or like it gets clicks or whatever, you know.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, that's such a good point. And I've seen so much growth in the slow press from your very first issue until, you know, your fourth volume right now. In terms of the scope, in terms of the kind of stories that you guys are featuring, so I mean, how reflecting on the past year or so, how do you think the slow press has changed and what are your hopes for it in the future?
Slow press has obviously changed quite a bit when we started. I think we are very happy with where we are at now. At the start, we were quite lost because there's so much to talk about and we are not very sure, like, who should we talk to and, like, whether they would give us the due support and respect. We got a few rejections from people who aren't even, like, very old in the industry. Like, they're also just starting out, but they're like, why do I need coverage from, like, such a small media? What do I get out of this?
They actually say thing? Such things to you guys, like, so honestly.
Yes. Oh. They said it to us, like, when we were working on the second volume, and we are like, all right, maybe we just don't touch them. Like, it's okay. Like, there will be people who believe in us and that we believe in, and I guess that has been the spirit that has been encouraging us all along. So I think for volume 3 and volume 4, we tried to do a lot more in terms of content and the length and depth of stories and what we wanted to cover. I think we did pretty long interviews that Ike helmed for both of the volumes. Yeah, and we also tried to do more like cultural pieces and bring in a lot more recipes for volume 4. So I think like how the slow press has grown, don't really want to compare in terms of like numbers or like how many contributors we have, but I feel like we are slowly refining how we look at food, even in terms of like our designers and our photographers. Sometimes it's like their first time doing like a food related shoot or their first time like eating something from a private dining kitchen, and it's very eye opening for them, and I'm so glad that I get to bring them on these adventures. I don't want it to be about me because I'm the person contacting the guy, right? Maybe the guy's like friends of friends, and like, I don't want it to be just me experiencing it. I want members of my team to be able to be there and feel for the food. So I think that's something that we want to continue doing this year. So we want to actively involve the designers and the photographers and videographers more so that all of us can go down, all of us can talk to the person and like feel the atmosphere for ourselves. Because I think it can be done very remotely. Like, you know, I just finish my piece and I pass it on to the designer who just has to read it and like try to like fit in something. But the person doesn't really know what I'm going through or like how the food even tastes like, right? I don't even think like the designers bother to like, I mean, they don't have to, they can do whatever they want and they feel comfortable with. But like, maybe if I'm talking about family recipe, I feel bad that I didn't like make her the ngoh hiang and like pass it to her, that kind of thing, right? Like, I feel like we just want to share all these experiences and continue sharing them with not just our team, but starting from our team, then to everyone else.
Yeah, and we're definitely trying to move towards more of longer, more involved, I guess like a bit more research heavy pieces. Yeah, so I think that's what we want to feature more of in the future.
Are you guys hopeful for the future of Singaporean food and that more young Singaporeans would actually start not just being consumers, but actually start cooking? Because I mean, it's very easy for someone to just go to a restaurant and eat local food or heritage food and say that you're supporting Singaporean food culture. But it's another thing to be intimately aware of the processes involved and curious about wanting to try these things at home.
I think there's been a bit too much focus on consuming as a way of interacting with food culture, right? So it's like, oh, you have to eat local food. You have to like hashtag support hawkers or whatever. Of course, that's important, of course, right? But yeah, it's so important if food culture is to like survive and thrive that we have a lot of people involved in the making of the food. They are more, they know more about the food. They're like, I don't know, educated. Is that a good word? Something like that. But returning to the question, I'm actually not very hopeful. Just because, you know, obviously a lot of wonderful efforts by everybody to preserve food culture. And I think that it will remain definitely in some way by those who like so-called carry the torch, right? But I don't know. I just feel like it's like the times where, you know, working hours are very long. People are always like, you know, working like 9 to 6, working overtime, long working hours, and not really not enough energy to invest in cooking or home cooking. And I don't know, I feel like there's a lot of things that lead me to think this way, right? Yeah, even like, you know, domestic helpers, where we have a huge portion of Singaporeans, Singaporean families are very reliant on domestic help, because you have like dual income households. You have people that are working, basically they're both, you know, both they're both working. Nobody, there's not enough time for people to cook. That's why they have to like rely on domestic help a lot of the times. And if they don't have the time to do that, then it's very hard for me to see a Singapore where there are a lot of people, a significant proportion of people that are home cooking, that are making their own food, that are intimately connected to their food in a way that is, that generally gives me hope for the future of food culture. Yeah. I feel like it's more of the circumstances rather than the, yeah.
I'm honestly quite worried because I cannot imagine how hawker centers will be like maybe 10 years down the road. People are like aging, the uncle can't fry his Hokkien Mee anymore, then where am I going to eat my Hokkien Mee, right? Other than like learning and cooking at home. But the experience will still be very different because now I just started like normal working hours and it's very easy for me to just walk over to Golden Mile and get everything I want. I can eat there for like 10 days, I'll never be sick of it because there's like so many different stalls and so many different foods there, right? But can you imagine that now, even now, we are like outsourcing a lot of our help to like foreign sources, I guess, maybe like Malaysians or like Chinese people who come and like be hawkers, right? And like how much of our local involvement like remains in these, like anyone can take a recipe from someone and like cook the same thing in the same way and sell it, but do they actually feel a connection to the dish? And what's the difference? Because there's this like food center near my house, Shunfu Market, right? And
Shunfu like, Market, did you just say Shunfu Market?
Yeah, Shunfu Market.
Well, that's the market closest to my house.
Oh my gosh, I go there like once a week.
I used to grow up at Lakeview.
Wow, Christy.
Wow, you should come back.
Yeah.
We can go to the market together. But anyway, there's like three prawn noodle shops, stalls at Shunfu Market, and they're all like almost side by side and selling everything at the same price. So it always puzzles me like, why would somebody choose this stall over another stall? And then nearby another coffee shop, there's also like one or two prawn noodle stalls, right? But what sets all these stalls apart? Are they just trying to sell something to make a living out of it? Like, I feel like there's not much thought. I mean, there doesn't need to be much thought lah, because like hawker centers aren't really like curated food places, you know? Somebody can just buy a license and just open a stall. But I think that changes a lot of like how we see food and how we want to consume it, because like for somebody who's just like walking into the hawker center, they'll just go for anything with the longest queue. It doesn't mean like the food of the other hawkers is not up to standard, or like I always feel a bit sad sometimes when like you see the disparity in terms of like queue numbers and people just like go for that as an easy way, or like they just search up on like food blogs, right? Like top 10 stalls to eat at this market. And people usually patronize those stores a lot more. But it doesn't mean that the other stores shouldn't be spotlighted or shouldn't be patronized, because I'm sure that they do good stuff. That's why they are still there and still surviving. So I don't want to be discouraged, but I am quite discouraged by how it's going to look like in the future when they eventually have to retire.
Thank you. Actually, I feel that every time I go back to Singapore, so much is changing. More stores are closing down, especially with COVID, right? And I am not very optimistic for, you know, like what you said, the future of hawker food and also home cooking, because I feel that there's so much going against it, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, just to remain hopeful, how do you think, you know, people like you who are potential future change makers in Singapore, and people like myself can actually make a difference? Because I mean, people have been talking about the need to preserve heritage food for the longest time. People have been championing hawker food culture, you know, and you know, with UNESCO coming in and things like that. But from your perspective, what do you think has been lacking in these conversations, or what has been lacking in our approach to promoting heritage food? And how can we kind of revitalize the conversation again?
I think it's still like too much of like talking about it but not actually doing it and making sure people see that you are doing it. I think it takes a lot of conscious efforts to like take the first step among your friends. like what I said about like Sunday brunch and stuff. Sometimes if my friends like suggest, oh, let's go eat like from like the same chain restaurant again, and then I'll be like, why don't we eat the hawker center nearby? I think it's a lot about getting exposed to these sources and varieties of food that we still lack. And even if people talk about it, you know, like National Heritage Board or like Singapore Food Festival, there's this period of time where they do like the our hawker culture hashtag thing again. And then when they talk about it, it's like, okay, well, we should check out this hawker center for char kway teow and it's famous. And everyone will just like center their attention to there for a period of time. And after like that campaign kind of like finishes up, then people don't really care about it anymore. I'm sure like people do think about it a bit more when like, I guess, government bodies or like cultural institutions mention these things, right? And like, I know people have been doing like heritage research, like Sarah Benjamin Tong has been doing hawker center research as well, and she's also a young person. But how much of whatever she does gets across to the mass audience, I'm not very sure. But I still feel like it's very, very important, and it's very interesting, like whatever she's doing for hawker. So I hope that that comes through a bit more in the next few years. And I guess for us as our generation, yeah, we can just try to do our part. And like, because we are the minority, I know it's hard, and it always starts somewhere. I'm sure like the Slow Press will try to get more people like food from our local culture. Like we are trying to, yeah, you know.
I feel like actually documentation is very important, especially in ways that are accessible to young people. As a young person myself, who is shamefully not very proficient in my mother tongue, for example, Mandarin, right? There are a lot of sources, a lot of valuable sources, where it's like, you know, maybe 20 years after, if in the case where any like particular food or thing disappears, you can still look back at like sources and then recreate it. That's what a lot of people are doing now, right? Like whatever Christopher Tan is doing with the kuih stuff, that's what he's doing, like reaching back, looking at all these documented sources. I feel like there needs to be a lot more documentation of stories, of the food, the recipes in English, because it's the most accessible for a lot of young people, right? Like myself. So that's one thing I feel that we should be doing. And yeah, just documentation in general, because that's what's important when, even if, yeah, like maybe 30 years down the line, when something is forgotten, that's how you potentially bring it back. If only if someone has taken the time and the love and the care to write it down, to preserve it, right? Then we can potentially bring it, protect it, even if it goes out of style or whatever. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's important.
Something to add. So I think like through my interviewing experience, even in school and for school friends, I feel like sometimes when we talk to like older hawkers or like business owners, they might be quite unwilling to like share about what they do. Sometimes they will just dismiss it as like, I do this every day and like nothing new. It's just like normal going to work. I come here, fry some noodles and go home. Like they'll literally tell me that. And then it's like, I'm sure there's a story, but I couldn't like seem to dig it out of them. And like, and that leads me to think like, are those profiles being featured on like mainstream media or like other outlets, like Our Grandfather's Story, right? Like are those profiles that are willing to be videoed, like only the profiles that will live on? Because it's like, yeah, it's also about the access between like the newsmaker and the journalist, right? If they don't want to share the story, then the story just like fades away and we never get to hear of it at all. So then we realize like a lot of the same people are being profiled, like the same heritage businesses. It feels a bit unfair to me. Like,
yeah,
we just can't have the best of everything. And,
yeah, I noticed that as well, you know, in my work with Singapore Noodles and with Wet Market The Table. I mean, some people are just very open and very generous with their stories, right? Wear their heart on the sleeve, very expressive, very good with words. But some people are just more private and more shy and like less media trained. That is one of the biggest struggles for me, especially with running the podcast, right? Where you really require your subject to be expressive, you know? It's like the hardest thing when you ask a question and the profile just says like just one line.
Yes, I love food. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Christy.
Yeah. So it's like very hard to unearth those stories. But for sure, I mean, what you're saying is very, very true. Then we lose another side of the perspective, right? Like so many different stories that are lost because of this. Yeah. Thank you guys for coming on the podcast. It's been really illuminating and really great to listen to the perspective of young people like you. And I mean, definitely it's given me more inspiration to continue the work that I'm doing. And I'm very happy that you guys actually got impacted by the work that I do, whether it's Wet Market to Table or Singapore Noodles, at least in like a small way. I'm very excited to see how the slow press will continue to grow and expand.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That wraps up another episode. You have been listening to Christy Chua and Tan Ayek of The Slow Press. We now stand at the crossroads where we are witnessing the vanishing of traditional dishes and the gradual erosion of our rich food culture. Now more than ever, it is so important to encourage one another to get back into the kitchen to cook. Singapore Noodles is offering a membership dedicated to equipping anyone with everything that they need to start cooking Singaporean food. Visit sgpnoodles.com to find out more. Once again, thank you for listening to the Singapore Noodles podcast, where we believe in a world in which Singaporeans are proud of our rich and diverse food culture and play an active role in keeping our food heritage alive.